You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. With more than 30 weekly podcasts, HRN has something for every food lover. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We do more varieties and flavors of cheese than anywhere else on Earth. By pushing the boundaries of what cheese can and should be, find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome to Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. I'm your host, Todd Shulkin, the Foundation's Executive Director. Our show takes you inside the Foundation's world to meet the talented people we have the great fortune of learning from all the time. On today's show, we welcome culinary historian Lenny Sorensen. In today's episode, we're going to talk to Lenny about African-American contributions to American food, her rural values, and we'll hear Lenny's Julia moment. Stay with us. We'll be right back. As always, we launch the conversation with an inspiration from Julia. On this show, we've talked about Julia's longstanding commitment to culinary history. Certainly, she was influential in expanding Americans' awareness of French food, but Julia also worked to improve our appreciation of American food. One of Julia's later career pivots was to focus on American talent and to highlight the depth of American food traditions, which, at least to much of the rest of the world, were often reduced to cheeseburgers, when in reality, they are much richer and more diverse. If you watch some of Julia's later television series, like Cooking with Master Chefs, she was focusing on what her guests were cooking on the American scene, even if many of the guests were French. That focus extended to supporting research into American culinary history, which at the time was kind of a nascent field. One way Julia did this was by helping raise money for preserving old cookbooks, which in turn helped elevate their inherent value. What you won't see in Cooking with Master Chefs is a lot of people of color, although the third episode featured the late Patrick Clark, an African-American chef who helmed the Hay Adams Hotel kitchen in Washington, D.C. 30 years ago, amplifying underrepresented voices was really not on the agenda. Thankfully, times and interests have changed. Someone who has been instrumental in showcasing those underrepresented voices fundamental to the development of American food is Lenny Sorensen. California-born, like Julia, Lenny ended up a South Dakota farmer before moving to Virginia, unlike Julia. While devoting herself to a rural existence, she earned an MA PhD in African-American history and culture from William & Mary and was the African-American research historian at Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's former plantation in Charlottesville, Virginia, which is now an educational center. Retired from Monticello, Lenny writes and lectures about food history and teaches rural life skills from her farm in Albemarle County, Virginia. If her voice sounds familiar, she was recently featured in Netflix's High on the Hog series, based on the book by Dr. Jessica Harris, who joined us in episode 32. Before embarking on a career in food and history, Lenny was a folk singer, a cast member of the musical Hair, catered for movie crews, and ran a tamale business. To say she is a jack of all trades is an understatement. She joins us today to share her insights about African-American contributions to American culinary history and about her rural values. Welcome to the podcast, Lenny.
Thank you very much. Good to hear your voice.
And yours. So let's just start with, when did your focus and attention turn to culinary history? Was there like one moment or was it a gradual process?
It was actually a very gradual process. I had always been an aggressive reader of history. I really dug that. And I dug my own family history. So I was always really into that. And when I went to farming, the thing that struck me was I knew very well that so much of American agriculture, especially in the South, had been done by Black people, enslaved Black people. And yet that didn't seem to be reflected. Somehow all Black people did was, pick cotton. And yet all those meals and all those cows that had to be milked and all that stuff that had to be done and all the food that had to be prepared was kind of left out. But as I farmed and really thought a great deal about it while I was out milking cows and cooking on wood and chopping wood, you know, I realized those were all activities that that Black people, enslaved and free, had been doing for, you know, a couple hundred plus years. And how could that story be told? At the time, I mostly just thought about it because I was busy doing. I will say, because I think everybody might be tickled to know, I got as a birthday present Edna Lewis's Taste of Country Cooking in 1977. And it was very, very important to me to read about a Black woman who understood farming. There were other Black women out there talking about food, but it was often very urban. And here I was out in the country. So that even more intensified my thinking. So that when I came to Virginia, I had an opportunity within the first few months that I was here. Actually, I had 128 pounds of sheep wool that I had to sell from my last shearing. And I gathered a bunch of people, put an ad in the paper. And one of these people was working at Ashlawn Highland, which is now called Highland. And she thought that I would be good as a craftsperson there because I could spin and do all that. And I went there to work. And in that setting, began to really use all the stuff that I'd been thinking about, Black people in agriculture, and particularly women, and Black people in gardening, and harvesting, and preserving, and doing all of the activities that, if you saw a menu for an elite table, you could look at that and break it out and figure out, okay, where did that food come from? Who raised it? How did it get processed? How did it get cooked? How did it get butchered? How did it, who did it, and how did they learn how to do it? All of those things. So it was progressive for me, and had just only intensified over the years.
Well, I'm struck in listening to you talk to you were going a bit against trend in the sense that my understanding, at least, is that because of the history of slavery, doing that kind of hard labor and particularly labor on the land was stigmatized as what you were trying to move away from rather than return to. Do you think that's true, or that it was undervalued or kind of set aside?
Well, of course, women's work has almost always been dismissed as just trivial. And back when I first started doing this stuff, I don't think there were any food studies programs in the United States, at least that I knew about. And so my thinking was, yes, we could talk about field labor, and there are incredible works on the rigors and horrors of field labor. And all of that and the details of it. But there's all of this domestic work that also had to be done and that was done to maintain the elite classes. And of course, it was all under, you know, the umbrella of slavery. There was no way to avoid that because that was the reality. So in that setting, how did all that stuff get done? Especially when we see when we read old cookbooks, when we read old diaries, journals, and letters, the excellence of the food, or the beauty of the wrought iron work in, say, a place like South Carolina, or the buildings that 200 years later are still standing and are gorgeous. How did people achieve such beautiful results under this really onerous burden that they all lived under? So to me, the food, I just wanted to focus on what did people have to know how to do And then what did they do? And, you know, I've been sometimes, because they didn't leave necessarily journals and letters, I have to do a bit of, you know, feeling about what they would feel about it.
Well, I'm struck by you're kind of talking about focusing a lot on the craftspeople and artisanship that went into the making, which included food and maybe elevating food to be in that category. And maybe a good way to shift to talking about that more specifically, we're entered February, it's Black History Month. And I know you have a lot of expertise in Virginia in particular, and having worked at Monticello, and I thought maybe you could describe what you're talking about through the lens of the contributions and innovations of the African Americans who made Monticello work.
Well, yeah. So you have, let's see, in 1776, the housemistress, Martha Wales Jefferson, wrote a fairly brief notice in her housekeeping book that they killed 15 hogs, made 240 pounds of soft soap, 240 pounds of hard soap, and 35 firkins of lard. Now, this was in January. Jefferson is obviously off somewhere being patriotic, and she's home. Okay, now this is her job. She is the housemistress. She's going to keep track of everything that gets produced, everything that gets brought in, everything that gets paid, all that stuff. That's her job. And I'm very glad she wrote that down, because with that, knowing the weather here and the situation, we can look and see, okay, how many people would it take to butcher 15 hogs? You know what I mean? You have to. And so,
she certainly didn't do all that work by herself.
No, she didn't do it at all. Do you see? She wrote it down and kept a record of it. So how can we break that out from, we use often maybe records that aren't quite that old that tell us, you know, how people butchered hogs in such quantity and who, what kind of work had to be done to do it. Well, I've actually butchered hogs. And so my sense of it gets down to, okay, how many men, how much water, how much fuel, how many lard kettles, how much salt, how many trenchers to put this stuff with the salt to go into the smokehouse, how much offals that had to be cleaned and made into souse, because nobody's going to waste any of that stuff. And indeed, both the elegant elite table, ate souse as well as the enslaved community, because it's a part, the offals are parts that don't last well. They have to be eaten fresh. And so how did all that play out? Then you have who's apprenticing, who's learning, who's working in the kitchen, who's the scullions, because all of during that, it had to have been at least a week of intense butchering activity in the house yard. There were still meals that had to be prepared and served every single day in the dining room at Monticello. So you have the cooks, you've got the scullions, you've got, you know, how to break that out so that, at Monticello, it's not so much a problem because we do have names of so many of the people that work there, and it's really so helpful in telling the stories. But in many other places, people don't have the names. They just have the numbers of workers, of enslaved workers that they had. So how can we give those workers a skill? Can we broaden out our interpretations? And that's always been a goal of mine, is if they had a cook, then this is what the cook had to know. So even though we don't know the name of the cook, we got what she had to know how to do. And teach her apprentice and teach her scullions and run that kitchen so that these meals, everything from medium fancy to fancy, could appear on the table every single day, every damn day. That's what the cooks and everything, along with, if you're going to eat strawberry jam in December, you had to make strawberry jam when there were strawberries. So sometimes you were cooking and doing all of the dinner and all of the prep while also making the strawberry jam that's going to be put up and used in December. So there's looking ahead, there's planning, there's obviously coordination with the mistress of the house, and depending on her skill, interest, expertise, whatever, which could be very, you know, really varied, a great deal of this fell on the cook to know what kind of ingredients you needed, how much needed to be bought and had and stored and used. All again under this incredible onerous burden of, if things got screwed up, or if there was an argument, if there was friction, if there was tension, if there was house laborers suffered under the same threat of sale and separation from family as anybody else. So I'm always still wondering, I just keep having it as part of my mind, remembering these people had amazing resilience that they found.
Yeah, like how did you excel at being skilled when you were unique pressures that different than a ordinary job?
And that you might not get any kind of feedback from the white family. You're not hearing, oh yeah, Betty Jane, she's fantastic, and the food was really wonderful, and thank you. No. They're eating what they expect to have presented at the table. And if anybody gets credit, of course, it's the mistress. So where are these people who are producing these excellent things? And like I say, wrought iron, beautiful houses, food, coaches, whatever, hats, all of that stuff. I really believe they're finding it within the community, within their own community. Everybody knows kind of who's good at what's, they have to find some appreciation somewhere, because as deeply oppressive as all of that was, I don't think people could be angry all the time.
Well, should we talk about, do you think it's fair, because there's been, he's sort of become famous in history of the cook or head chef that worked for Thomas Jefferson, James Hemings. How long was he actually the head chef at Monticello? And is he someone you would like to focus on? Or are there some other people that you think now? Yeah. Go ahead.
Remember, he died in 1800. So he died just before, or just as Jefferson, maybe 1801, went to the president's house. James, when they returned from France, and James had obviously learned very deep skills as a chef and had been cooking for Jefferson in Paris and then in Annapolis as Jefferson returned. Jefferson made an offer. Let's put it this way. Everybody keeps calling it an agreement, but if you see the paper, it isn't signed by James, which is hardly an agreement to me. It ain't a deal because, his name isn't on it. He just says, if you'll come home to Monticello and teach whom I shall choose to learn the art of French cookery, I will manumit you. And he does come home. And this is in...
Yeah, the inference is they would have had some conversation where, presumably, though, you would have to say James Hemings made some sort of request or demand, or Jefferson wouldn't have offered that in the first place, would he?
And, Jefferson wanted the food he wanted. You know what I mean? And he wanted that food wherever it is that he was. And he knew, I think he really knew that he was not going to be able to depend on James to come home to Monticello permanently. And so, but he did come in 1796. And he spent 18 months, I believe, teaching Peter, his younger brother, who himself was became a very fine cook, probably already was skilled, and then went on in later years to become a fine brewer and cider maker. So there was that. They, when they were in that kitchen that has now been archaeologically dug and shown, and it's really fantastic to see it, they would have had scullions. And I believe that the two young women who ultimately end up at the president's house, Edith Fawcett and Frances Hearn, were just at the right age to be scullions in that kitchen. And because then I'm trying to make a sense out of when Jefferson went to the president's house, James was freed and gone. Peter had a local family, and from what I understand, made a particular plea to Jefferson to not send him to the president's house so that he would, you know, be separated from his family. And Jefferson sent the two young women to the president's house.
I see.
And
so Peter Hemming stayed at Monticello.
Yes, which means every vacation when the president went home and spent a couple of months there, Peter was the cook. The girls, as they were often called, stayed in Washington.
Well, because I was going to say, what age would they have started as scullions? Probably 12 or something like that?
Well, eight or nine. Yeah.
Very young.
Early. Right. Yeah. But they would have learned. Scullions learned, you know, scullions' jobs were wood in, ashes out, water in, slops out, stir this, pound that. You know, you had to pound the sugar, you had to pound the salt. They would have performed those kinds of functions under the eagle eye of the cook. And so when Jefferson decided to send, Edith was the first that went, I believe he probably already had some good idea. He may have spoken to Peter about this, of who was going to be amenable. You can't have somebody in the kitchen who is fractious or rebellious or disorganized or, you know, can't keep their attention on things. You have to have somebody in the kitchen that is going to pay attention and be obedient and do, because they've got this big damn meal happening every day that has to be, depending on the season of the year, it would be anywhere from 2 o'clock until maybe 4 or 5 to be served. And Edith obviously fit the role, and I believe it's because she's already had some level of probably scullion level apprenticeship. And when she goes, then she and Frances joins her the next year. They are there during Jefferson's entire presidency, working under the French chef Honoré Julien.
Well, in Jefferson, right? Maybe mixing up my history, but his wife died relatively young, and he was a widower for
10 years. Before he was a widower, had been a widower before he went to France.
He didn't remarry, did he? Or not officially?
No, he was never married.
Single president, if you will.
And he did, and he made changes at the White House that were elegant and dramatic, the way the service with the tables and the kinds of meals he had, which means that he was, by this time, of course, he had been deeply influenced by the French cookery that he had had before he went to France in various French households. And then when he got there and James did his apprenticeships in various venues. And so James was an extremely experienced, in the art of French cookery. And then, that's what he wanted. And now to have these two young women learning under a French chef. And he also had a French maître d'Lemar who did the shopping for the president's household. So there's this influence that the young women are under for 8 years. I just recently asked somebody at a conference in Asheville, the Chow Chow Festival. There were a whole bunch of chefs there because they were part of presenting this meal. I said, how long do you have to go to apprentice and learn to become at least where you can call yourself a chef, even if you're not, you know, real experience? And they said 18 months, you know, so these young women were 8 years, one can assume they were very, very good at what they did.
So, Lenny, these two women who cooked for Thomas Jefferson when he was president, I wanted you to repeat their names so we know them clearly, and also ask you, do you know what happened to them after they worked for the president?
Yes, in April of 1809, they returned to Monticello, and Honoré Julien, the chef under whom they had worked for 8 years, came with them. And in that, together, they set up the kitchen that we know now, that Monticello reconstructed, the big hearth, the bake oven, the stew stove, all of that had been being built in the intervening years, as Jefferson was constantly, finishing and doing Monticello. Well, that kitchen had been finished, but it now needed to be set up. It needed to be tested. The hearth had to be started and all of that work. And after a couple of weeks, Julien made a report that he felt that the girls were well settled in and would do a fine job. And at that point, they then proceeded to cook in that kitchen until Jefferson's death. So they then had another, decade and a half.
And were they freed upon Jefferson's death, or did they live out the rest of their lives there?
When Jefferson's estate sale was done in his will, he freed five men, one of whom was Joseph Fawcett, who was Edith's husband. He was a blacksmith, but he did not free Edith nor any of their children. And so Edith and a number of the children were sold to different settings. And it took Joe Fawcett a number of years to, with the help of some white helpers and many of his black family, free black family in Charlottesville, to buy them. And in 1837, you couldn't free. If you freed somebody, they had to leave the state within a year. So he had to, as he bought them, he had to hold them as slaves until he was ready to leave. And just before he left, he freed his wife and all of his children, but his youngest son, and they went to Ohio. But Frances and her husband and children were sold to a professor at UVA, and they were not freed.
Yeah, wow. I'm just struck by that's such, like, there's hope in that story, but there's a lot of horror in the fact that you could serve your country in the way those women did and still end up enslaved and separated. In this day and age, hearing that kind of, they did these amazing things and then they were sold like chattel is so disturbing.
Because that's what they were. That is the legal term.
Well, thank you very much. So tell me their names again. One was Edith Fawcett.
Edith Hearn Fawcett and Frances Gillette Hearn.
Well, I think the solace I'm going to take is that their contributions were recorded and we can know and talk about and honor their legacy now.
Yes. And at Monticello, over certainly the last decade, more and more information about their families and their descendants and their work has been researched and opened out. And if you went there and you took the kitchen tour, you're going to see and hear much more about them. And that's wonderful, to have them recognized. It's important to have them recognized.
Absolutely. We're going to take a break and we'll be back with more from culinary historian Lenny Sorensen. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Wisconsin, the state of cheese, makes half of the nation's specialty cheese and wins more awards than any other state or country. Our heritage and traditions, master cheesemaker program, and the American propensity for innovation all put Wisconsin on the cutting edge of cheesemaking. With over 600 varieties of cheese to choose from and 5,500 national and international awards and counting, get ready to turn your refrigerator into a trophy case. Enjoying a Wisconsin cheese is basically like winning a gold medal in culinary achievement. Set your mind at cheese. When you bite into a wedge of Wisconsin Wonderful, you know it is made with the ultimate skill and passion possible. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome back. We're talking to culinary historian Lenny Sorensen about her passion for culinary history and rural values. So, Lenny, I didn't want to have you on knowing how committed you've been and how you didn't even start there to living a rural lifestyle. And I think we talked about at the top of the show, a lot of that involves artisanship and craftsmanship in addition to just farming. But I was curious of your perspective also as a historian, that we've also been following the overall rural trends in America, which are true in other parts of the world too, that farming continues to become large and large scale. And that's also sort of going hand in hand with a depopulating of our rural environments, which are still really key to our survival. And I was just curious to get your perspective of, you know, what we're losing, and more importantly, what people who aren't focused on that should be reorienting and what they should care about, because it has an effect whether you live rural or urban.
Well, the urban, yes, we have lost, especially in the large-scale farming, because it's very expensive to farm thousands of acres of anything because of the technology and the needs for it. But I am encouraged because, just as happened kind of in the late 60s through the 70s into the early 80s, there has been a resurgence of people wanting to make rural lives, younger people wanting to make rural lives. And many of them, I'm delighted, are a significant number, far more than one would have imagined, I guess, of our people of color who are out there doing market garden level farming. They're growing beef and they've got sheep and they're growing eggs and they're growing lavender and they're growing herbs and they're making salves and they're growing honey and they're got veg and they've got high tunnels and they've got, you know, just incredible variety of people trying to go to explore and use the rural, especially in the rural South. It's a little more than I think in the North, because it's just so damn cold in the North. You know what I mean? Who wants a farm up there? To tell you the truth, now I'm being a little cynical, but there certainly is.
Well, true. The warmer climate, the longer your growing season, and all right? That.
And I think maybe, one of the problems with all of that is that land is so expensive because farmers whose kids don't want to farm. There is nothing wrong with your kids not wanting to farm. Do you see what I mean? You can't blame the kids. It's that we have a system, though, that makes it very difficult for a farmer to resist the blandishments of the, you know, realtors want a billion mega homes, you know, and do that because, and their kids don't want the land. So then what do they do? How do they find replacements for them to learn? And I think that's something that is, it's a long and complicated conversation, and I don't mean to have it sound facile, but I believe that there is a conversation to have about how to help farmers find people who want to farm their land or who want to milk those cows, who want to do this stuff, but who cannot afford the land, but might be able to buy in or buy shares and yet still not deprive the children of that farmer from their inheritance. They are entitled, an inheritance from their parents. And so how to make that work? Those are very complicated, and some of them are like probably a lot of legal stuff, but I would like to see the spirit of it be broached and looked at to see, so that people can go and live on 25, 30, 50, 60 acres and actually make stuff. There are a lot of people who don't want to be rich. They just want to make a living. They just, you know what I mean? And those people need to be helped to do that.
Anyway, so do you think I think what you're saying is because land, particularly in arable and, you know, environmentally rich areas where you could mm-hmm. do these things is expensive, there needs to be some kind of subsidization program to make it possible, because in the current economics, it's extremely out of balance.
Yeah. Right. And how to work on a social cultural level with elders to help them understand how they can have their the land that they work, that they've spent their lives working on, continue, even if their children don't want to actually do that work, so that they're not just it's not just a black and white, well, the kids don't want the land, so I'm going to have to sell it. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I'm struck by, actually, we talked to Frank Reese, who I don't know if you've ever encountered him, but he's one of the last remaining standard poultry breeders. And he's in Kansas, and he doesn't have any children. And mm-hmm. he's been in this quest to find apprentices because there are so few people who know how to breed poultry naturally. And that he's described in many of the ways you just, it's both an art and a science. And that you really have to learn by doing, and there's a certain feel. And, you know,
yep.
we're talking about how the avian flu crisis is really brought into sharper focus. The point he's been yelling from the rooftops for years. And I think that's an example of what you're talking about.
And I think the dairy industry in places like Vermont, where many of the workers on these dairy farms, you know, so you've got a herd of, I don't know, 200, 300, 400 cows. They've all got workers that work on them. And many of times these workers are immigrant workers from various places all over the world. How to help, and some of them have been working in these places for, you know, 5, 10, 15 years. Their kids go to the local schools. Do you know what I mean? They've all, how to help those workers buy in to owning that, to eventually owning that dairy operation, so that that dairy operation doesn't go defunct.
And do you think that really has to come from a kind of national policy and from that side, that it, or possibly from non...
Yeah, no, it would help to have national and fiscal policies in place such that when the emotional, educational conversation begins to be had, it can be pointed out, oh, well, these are some ways you can handle that. Oh, these are some ways that people are doing it. Oh, these are some ways. Do you see what I mean? As opposed to having to reinvent, you don't have to reinvent the whole thing in whole cloth. I spoke to a lady.
If only we could shift the culture wars and the urban-rural divide to focus on something like bridging that gap rather than some of the other silliness.
Yes. And there's a lot of tension which has to be diffused, which unfortunately in the political climate that we've had for really quite a while, is that notion that somehow there's this vast gulf between people in the city and people in the country. And I don't, when I see people in the city who have urban gardens, who are growing chickens, who have, who are going to farmers markets, and it's, and while also fighting these other larger lack of good marketplaces in places of high concentrations of the poor and people of color. I mean, there's a lot of battles to be fought, but there's a lot of things being done also. Do you see what I mean? And so I don't know. I may be very utopian, but, you know.
No, I think that's great. And I think that there's a draw, because it's a natural human thing to be drawn to the land. And I think as people are tiring of having everything made of plastic, and that the loss of that connection between human life and land and organic things, in both areas, people are more drawn to doing these things, uplifting these things, sustaining these things, but it's a slow process.
Yeah, and they happen in cycles. I'm old enough. I was just 80 last summer, and I've watched several cycles of this back to the land or counterculture movement or whatever they people choose to call it. Is that we have to have a sensible approach to, you know, people wanting to be, to have these experiences and to help them be able to do it. And now what's great is we've got all this technology. God, I got to tell you, if my husband and I had had all this technology when we were on the farm, I can't imagine that we would have ever left the farm.
I was just going to say that. It's kind of ironic, right, that it may be tech, which is in some ways artificial.
It's not. It's not artificial. Humans have been using tech ever since they discovered a wheel. That's tech. You know, we just
seem to have. So you just see it as an evolution of a plow. It's just a different form.
I don't have any kind of, you know, big ideas about how, oh, God, the world is going to hell in a handbasket because now everybody's got a smartphone. I'm so glad to have a damn smartphone. I can't even hardly stand it, to tell you the truth. I can talk to people and meet people on this computer that I would never have had a chance to meet and interact with. You know, I got a canning comrade in Texas. I would never have met this woman. I would have no occasion to meet her. And she has been so helpful to me and so encouraging and, you know, all of that. But the
and
technology.
So are you canning the same thing in Virginia as Texas, or are you canning different things?
Yeah, she cans all kinds of stuff. And even with her season, now she just started, I had to jump her ass the other day because she's already started putting seeds in the ground, okay, in Texas. I said, don't even tell me about it. My ground's frozen to 5 inches. But she's dehydrating, and that's not a thing that she persuaded me to get a dehydrator. And that's been a new technology for me. That's been really cool. I mean, I've been doing all this other stuff for 40, 50 years. Now I got a dehydrator, you know.
That's what I was going to ask you before we go to break. What is your current focus on the farm or as a historian, or where are you putting your time and energy right now?
I do it all, kids. It's all the same thing. If somebody wants to talk about the history of food, I go talk about it. Sometimes we make a little bit of food from the past, and that's fun. If I'm talking about canning, then if I've got 6 students here and we're canning peaches and tomatoes, we're still talking history. If I'm canning, I got pressure canning students and we're putting up meat and chicken, well, we're talking about raising animals and butchering animals and cooking animals. If I've got a 150-pound half carcass of pig, I'll just have a class and we'll all cut it up and they'll learn about how to cut it up. Not that they're necessarily going to ever cut up 150-pound half carcass of a pig again in their entire life, but they will never forget it. And they will have a sense of every time they go to the butcher, oh yeah, I remember that. I remember cutting that chop and cutting that roast. See what I mean? I'm not
So you're really integrating your two passions into a kind of living history experience.
Always have. That to me is what makes it fun is, you know, you're doing a thing. Otherwise, somehow, if it's just the history, then you're kind of talking about 200-year-old dead people, and I'm not that interested. And if you're doing practical aspect, then it's, you know, cutesy gingham. I'm not going to name any names, but you can imagine who I might be thinking of, you know, aspects of, you know, kitschy food shit. Oh, I'm not supposed to do that, but I did it anyway. and do you see what I mean?
And I'm struck by that's also like the value of visiting Monticello. Someone can tell you about Monticello, you can read it in a book, but until you stand in those rooms, you don't feel it and experience it. And it also really crosses that divide, because if you can stand in a place that's 200-300 years old
and know what happened there. It's like that's why people go to Civil War battlefields. Every time I drive up 20 and I drive through the wilderness and then I drive through, you know, those places, I'm stunned. You're cracking me up
because my father and my mom are both historians. My dad's an American historian, and I have probably been to like 75% of all the
of all of those places.
Yeah, in America. That's like my entire childhood visiting.
Yeah.
Those
I've been
markers.
To all. Yeah, and I've been to all the kitchens, you know, and all the backyards and all the gardens. I'm about as metaphysical as a brick. You know what I mean? To tell you the truth, but I find those places deeply evocative, and I want to tell those stories, and I want to share it, and you know, that's so I share it on all levels, whether we're outside and I'm teaching, I do an annual class of called chicken, raising chickens for eggs, which I often call chicken 101, with, you know, 8 or 9 students. And well, of course, we're still talking about the history of chickens. How
I was going to say, I think you'll have a big crop of students this
yeah,
year with
you know
the
what
egg
I mean?
Shortage. So
oh,
there you go.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, we have every year. I'm in the process now of figuring out ordering more chicks, you know, for my purposes. But I like bringing people to my space is really wonderful for me. And building, I now have a 501c3 foundation, and that's going to help me bring more people to my space and to teach and talk and do, you know, that's kind of what I do.
That is amazing. All right, we're going to take our last break. And when we come back, we'll hear Lenny's Julia moment. Let us know what you think of today's show. Send us an email or voice memo to contact@juliachildfoundation.org. We'll be right back.
When you flip anything, you just have to have the courage of your convictions, particularly if it's sort of a loose mess like this. No, that didn't go very well. See, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it the way I should have. But you can always pick it up, and if you're alone in the kitchen, who is going to see?
From Julia's immortal words, we move into our last segment, which we call the Julia moment. Here's when we ask our guests to share their favorite Julia memory moment or how she's inspired them in their career. Lenny, it sounds like you relate to that statement. What's your Julia moment?
I don't remember when the show was, but it was black and white. It wasn't color. But it must have been, because there had been long times in my lives when I've lived without a television. So I would have had the TV. And I'm thinking in the 60s, didn't she have her whole series in the 60s when PBS
ran that? Yeah,
it ran
from about 63 to 73, or it's a little bit fuzzy.
Something like, about in there.
And it went into color in about 68, I think.
No, and I didn't have I didn't have a color television until 75. So she pulls out this duck and she says that the best thing you can do with duck, I'd never cooked a duck. In fact, I don't know, I'm not sure if I'd ever even eaten a duck, to tell you the truth. But here she is with this duck. And she says, well, you know, in her voice, because she's very practical, about how ordinarily you have to cut it into quarters because that's the way it breaks up. And then you can only feed 4 people. But how she's been very clever. She's figured out how to debone the duck by turning it inside out and taking all the bones out and collapsing the breast, you know, because ducks have that long rib cage, okay? Mm-hmm. Collapsing it all together so that you can slice it across the whole breast section and you can feed 6 people. Okay. So then she gets into, and now, of course, to me, which is incredibly funny and wonderful, is that she starts on the hind end, you know, and we won't go there too much. But anyway, so she starts turning this duck inside out, cutting as she goes. And she ends up with this duck literally turned inside out with the bones, with all of the breastbones, coming out. And so she's got this duck bag, okay? And then she turns it back inside. She turns it back inside in. And she seasons it, and then she roasts this duck. Well, I don't have a duck. But what I did have, of course, was a chicken. And I practiced on a number of chickens, and I learned how to turn a chicken inside out from Julia. And I've always called her that, and I guess everybody does, how to do it. And so then I was doing that with chickens, and that was a lot of fun. And so then I did it with a turkey. And so all of these years later, now I just spatchcock the bird because it's just easier But I still take all the bones out. So I almost all of the chickens that I process for my own freezer that I'm going to roast whole, and all of my turkeys for Thanksgiving, I have deboned them all the way. And I debone them. I take the thigh bone out. I take that top wing bone out so that these birds are well-seasoned and collapsed on themselves and tied loosely and in turkey shape. Because they are juicier, they taste better, they're easier to cut, and the mixture of the dark meat pressed against the white meat makes the white meat juicier and nicer.
And you credit this inspiration for doing it, back to seeing Julia do it.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, no, I'll never forget her. I'll never forget her turning that damn duck inside out. I was absolutely hysterical. And I thought, well, that makes absolute sense. And then I have since, I then raised, many years later, we raised 12 ducks, Pekin ducks. And the problem with Pekin ducks is that they're almost impossible to actually scald and pick. They're just very, that's why one of the reasons duck is so expensive. It's very, very hard to pluck a duck really well. And so I had these, and I realized I will never raise another duck in my life. It's kind of, that's where that went. But I paid extra to have these ducks done, plucked. And I did, in honor of Julia, I did debone a duck. You know,
that you'd raised yourself.
That I had raised from chicks, raised from ducklings ourselves. It came in a box. You know, when you get chicks and ducks, they come in a box from the hatchery, and you go to the post office and you pick them up, and then you bring them home, and you take off the lid, and they all look up at you. Well, chickens aren't quite the same because they're kind of silly and really stupid. But ducks, I wish I had a camera because my husband took the lid off and looked down at them, and they all looked up at him and they all said, "Dad."
Oh.
And they just became his buddies from then on. They imprinted immediately on my husband, which was good because I was going to be the one that butchered them. So it didn't matter.
Yeah, I was going to say, so he left that to you. After.
Yeah. No, I don't, I am not anthropomorphic at all about animals. They're all, you know, I don't eat baby animals, so I'm not really worried about that. You know what I mean? I wait till they're big enough that they're actually going to be able to serve a few people.
Fair enough.
But I will never forget Julia and her doing the duck inside out was priceless. And it was 50 years ago, and I have never forgotten it. And I tell it every single time I teach people how to debone a turkey, which I do fairly often.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Lenny.
You are very welcome. This has been a lot of fun.
Likewise. And thanks, everyone, for listening. If you want to learn more from Lenny, who has a lot to teach, you can check out indigohouse.us on Facebook and also on the web. It's at indigohouseva on Instagram. You might want to check out, and maybe there will soon be the deboning clip, from Julia Child and from the French Chef. It's at Julia Child on Facebook. There are new video clips being posted weekly. Please follow at Julia Child Foundation on Instagram. I'm at T. Shulkin on Instagram. The 2023 Taste of Santa Barbara is coming up May 15 to 21. Follow at SB Culinary Experience on Instagram for the latest news about events in and around Santa Barbara, including a soon-to-be-announced spring pop-up. The Julia Child audio clip from The French Chef is used with permission from our friends at GBH. Thanks, as always, to my co-producer of the foundation, Lauren Salkeld, and our sound engineer at Heritage Radio Network, Armin Spengen. Our theme song is New French Horn by Novi Valtorni. We're on the air on Heritage Radio Network on Thursdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, with downloads available soon after wherever you find your podcasts. We look forward to bringing you back into the foundation's world next time on Inside Julia's Kitchen. Inside Julia's Kitchen is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.